I jump out and I go running down this hill and I'm hitting on these rocks. And I remember thinking, oh my gosh, I'm going so fast and I'm just trying to keep myself from falling. If I fall, I'm going to die. I mean, there's no way I'm going to survive if I fall. So I get down to the bottom of the bank of the hill and I'm standing there. And I realize what he did is he didn't flip the car. He rode it like a sled right into the water. So he's got the police car sitting there in the water. He's standing outside of the car. He's got a gun in his hand. I'm right there at the bank with him and on the bank of the river. And I have no cover. I have nothing. It's just me and him, you know, standing there. It turns out there were some other guys that came down there too. Another guy ran right down behind me, but I don't remember seeing him. I was just tunnel visioned on him now. I draw my weapon. And I say, drop the gun. And all I can remember is he looked right at me and he raised the gun up.
Hi, guys. Welcome back to part two of this week's episode with Game of Crimes with Murph in the Morning here. Our guest this week is Alan Manganiello, retired Louisville police officer who now runs his own jiu-jitsu academy and has for quite a number of years. We're going to get more into that. If you came with us yesterday, then you know where we are in the interview process. If you didn't, go back and listen to part one first. But where we are is Alan has finished the police academy in Louisville, and he's now on the streets out there protecting the public. And he, if you remember from yesterday's episode, he got to submit a wish list as to where he'd like to be stationed in the city. And he selected the most active area of the city, which typically becomes the most dangerous area of the city as well. But I'm pretty sure that's what most cops want to do when they first get out there, because you certainly don't want to go out there and do funeral escorts and get cats out of trees, because that's the fire department's responsibility. We don't step on their toes. But, and we were just saying, what the heck is wrong with us that we want to do things like that? But when you sign on with this job, you're a public servant, just like all our first responders are, our military. All of our politicians, those people up there that sit in Washington and think they're holier than thou, they're public servants as well. I know a lot of people look at that as a derogatory term. I don't. I look at it as a badge of honor. If you're serving your fellow man, there is no higher calling in our society, in Murph's opinion.
That's right. You're exactly right.
So, thank you, Alan. I appreciate you backing me up there, brother. So you're out on the street now. And during your career, did you ever get assigned to any task forces, the DEA task force, FBI, any of those?
No, none of the task forces. As far as we worked with them quite a bit. It's been about off and on throughout my 22 year career. I spent about 14 years on patrol. So I spent a lot of my time, you know, doing that as my favorite thing on the department. I just like the fact that every day it was something different, you know. But I did get on with a unit called the Viper Unit. The Viper Unit was a violent crime task force where, you know, they had the narcotics unit where you go out looking for drugs and dope dealers and stuff. Our job was to try to get illegal guns off the street. So we were looking for the guys doing carjackings, robberies, that kind of thing. The most violent criminals in Louisville, they started the Viper Unit. Oh gosh, I don't even remember what year it was now. It was like probably 2011, maybe something like that, somewhere around there. We were out there hunting the most violent criminals in town, and they wound up, and we worked with the FBI and DA and all that. They picked 25 of us off the department. So it was pretty honorable to be able to be picked for this, because everybody was applying for it, and they picked 25 of us to be able to go do it. Actually, our buddy John Mattingly was one of the guys on that unit. So I was on the original Viper Unit with him as well. And then I guess they thought the name was a little too scary for the public, and we're a pretty aggressive unit, and you can actually look up the stats of crime in Louisville. And while the Viper Unit was instated there, crime went way down. You can see that the crime just dropped. And then when they disbanded the Viper Unit, you see it start to go back up again. So, and they turned the Viper Unit into what's called the 9th Mobile Unit. We have 8 divisions in Louisville, 8 different areas that we work in, precincts, divisions, whatever you want to call them. And they made the Viper Unit what's called the 9th Mobile Unit, so where it didn't really stick with any one area. That was also the unit that had the Breonna Taylor situation.
Right.
So that was our unit that turned into that. So I did work with a lot of the DEA and FBI and those guys and a lot of different cases that we were working on.
Did Viper end up being like a SWAT team, or did you guys have a separate SWAT team?
No, we had a separate SWAT team because I was on the SWAT team as well. So at the time, we had a part-time SWAT team, and I was on the Viper Unit. And then if we got called, if the SWAT team got called, I have to leave my Viper Unit responsibility and go do the SWAT call. Mm-hmm. So I was actually on both at the same time, which was super fun. That was like my dream job. So
a lot of adrenaline every day.
Oh, yeah. Every day it was something.
Did you have just one SWAT team or you had multiple teams?
Well, we had one SWAT team, but it was broken up into two. We had team one and team two. So we always had, because being there was a part-time team, one team would always be on call. And then the other team was just there for warrants if we were on duty. If we had to do warrants or something like that, whoever was on call had to go do the warrants and that type of thing. If we had a hostage situation or a barricaded subject, everybody got called out. You just went. So
wow,
we did it.
How long were you on Viper and on SWAT? How many years?
I was on Viper unit for about 4 years until they disbanded it. When they became the 9th mobile unit, I was on there for a few more months, almost a year. And then I wound up going back to patrol again. I just wanted to go back there. I missed it. And I didn't like what the 9th mobile unit was doing. It wasn't the same. It was under different management, different leadership. And it just wasn't the same as the Viper unit was. So I wasn't as interested. And then I was on the SWAT team for 7.5 years.
In Viper, were you in uniform or plain clothes?
It was plain clothes. We had an outer carrier vest that said police and badge and everything, but we just wore it. Like nobody would ever recognize us. We all wore camouflage cargo shorts, ball cap, and a black t-shirt. I mean, let's go figure. Like, and everybody had goatees, though. Nobody will ever know we're cops.
Yeah. That's the uniform. That's right.
That's right.
I love it. When I was in Atlanta, I was stationed in Atlanta a couple times, actually, with DEA, and Atlanta PD had a unit called direct dog units. That would be 4 guys per car, 3 cars in a little patrol. So you got 12 guys. That's who you called when you had problems. And if they came rolling in, people would disperse because these weren't little guys. I think they had a height and weight requirement to get in Red Dog. But of course, down the road, somebody complained and you know how things go. And for our listeners, don't think that we're condoning violence. Police officers are facing violence. They're combating violence. And yet sometimes you've got to combat violence with violence. You've got to be ready to go. You know, just don't walk up to a violent criminal and say, okay, come with me. And he says, okay, put the cuffs on me. Here we go.
Right.
Most of the time, those kind of guys are going to fight. They're going to run. There's a tussle. Sometimes bad things happen.
That's exactly right.
You had an incident, didn't you, where had a very, very bad incident.
Yes. We had a situation where there was these two guys, Kevin Sneed and Jerry Thornton were their names, as a matter of fact. And they were going around robbing places. Actually, it was in the tri-state area here. We have Kentucky, Ohio, and Indiana. They all touch right there. And they were going around doing robberies. And what they were doing is they would go into a restaurant and they would case the restaurant first. They would case it and find out where the doors were, all that kind of stuff, what time people would either do a money drop or leave or whatever. And they would go in and they would rob the place. And they would try to do it when there's a lot of people in there so they would get like cell phones, watches, whatever they can get from people. They'd rob these restaurants. And they started getting, like I said earlier in the first episode, they started getting cocky. Once you're with one robber, you get confidence and you figure, oh, I got this down. I'm pretty good at this. Let's do some more. And they started doing it to convenience stores, restaurants, all that kind of stuff. They got to the point where they were locking people in the back freezer of a restaurant. And that way they couldn't call the cops or anything like that. Even got one point where they started firing rounds into the ceiling. So now they're starting to really escalate.
Yeah.
Starting to get up there. Well, they had over 70 robberies. So obviously they were pretty good at it because they weren't caught yet.
See?
They had over 70 robberies in the tri-state area.
Wow.
Well, obviously we were all aware of them. We knew who they were. We're on the lookout for them, trying to find them and all this kind of thing. Well, our robbery unit figured out who they were. They put trackers on their vehicles because we wanted to get them to where they were going to go in. We could get these guys. They were casing a Wendy's hamburger joint right here in town.
Really?
One night. Yeah, of all the things, I just decided they're gonna hit a Wendy's, of all things. It was kind of weird because they were hitting Outback steakhouses and bigger restaurants, that kind of stuff too, but now they're going to hit a Wendy's. Well, they saw them doing casing, saw them driving around the Wendy's, and their MO was they would case it one day and they'd hit it the next day. There was a detective across the street in a parking lot working on some paperwork, and they said, hey, they're casing this Wendy's, and he's like, oh, that's right across the street from me. And they said, all right, let's follow them because tomorrow they're going to wind up hitting this place. Well, all of a sudden, the alarm went off. They decided to hit it that night. They're just like, oh, we're going to go get them now. So they already robbed the place. And the detective said, hey, I'm behind them right now. They're in a truck. So he's following them. He's like, get me some cars over here. I'm not going to light them up yet, obviously, until we get some cars. Well, Need and Thornton were onto it. They recognized the police car, unmarked Crown Vic, just following them around. It's kind of obvious what's
a little called. Obvious.
Yeah. And after you do 70 robberies, you kind of have a lookout for cops and everything anyway.
Yeah.
So he's following them. Well, they get into a car chase and he starts taking off. So he's chasing them through the city and all this thing. At the time, I was actually working an accident and it was super cold. This was December 23rd. of 2008, as a matter of fact. And it was 6 degrees outside. I'll never forget. It was freezing cold. And they're chasing this guy, and I can hear him going through the radio, going through the city and all that kind of thing. They wound up getting him not too far from where I live. And I was working not too far from where I lived at that time either. But the car pulls over, and I'll use my hands here the best we can here. But as the truck pulls right here, the police car that was coming this way pulled over this way. So he's parked right. This is the police car, and here's the suspect's truck. What does everybody do when they do a felony stop like that? They rush the vehicle. You're not supposed to call them back to you, okay?
Right.
But anyway, all their adrenaline is flying and everything. The police gets out of this car and runs directly to the driver. And Jerry Thornton is driving the truck. As soon as he runs, this is just like something that you see in a movie. As he runs here, Kevin Snead jumps out of the passenger side of the truck, and they literally pass each other. He jumps in the police car and takes off.
Oh, jeez.
So he steals the police car. So now we hear, hey, he just took my car. And we're like, are you serious right now? Is this real life? So now they're chasing a police car through the city. Well, I'm on one road. The street I live on runs perpendicular to this other road. And they're on the second road. They're over here on what's called Newburgh Road. And as they're coming, and I'm on what's called Bardstown Road, which runs parallel to it. I can hear that they're coming towards this direction over on Newburgh. And so I decide to take the street I live on straight down past my house. Everything, I go straight down the road, and I'm getting to that intersection. I know they're coming towards me. And as they're coming towards me, I remember thinking, man, I'm at the stop sign. I'm like, should I turn left? But then I could very possibly pass them. Or should I wait? And when they pass me, I'll just jump in the chase then.
Mm-hmm.
Then I realized there's an expressway down the road, and they're coming up on this expressway. I said, I guarantee he hits the expressway. Yeah. So I remember thinking, gosh, what do I do? What do I do? And I was a little frustrated. I was like, come on, let's go. Let's go make a decision, Alan. So I decided I'm going for them. So I took a left and I went towards them. And as I was coming up on them, there he goes right on the expressway, and I get in right behind him. So now I'm the car directly behind the police car.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's kind of a crazy sight, right? Because we're just going down the expressway, and all the drivers on the expressway, they just see a bunch of police cars. They don't realize the very first one's a bad guy.
Right.
You know?
Right.
So everybody's getting out of the way, and we're going, and he goes off the road. And then one of the robber unit guys comes up. He's in an unmarked black Bronco. He winds up hitting the back of the car. It goes off the road behind the guardrail. Any one of us, we were wrecked and spinned out. But no, he gets back on the expressway and keeps going. So the chase is still on. We're going through the city. We probably have 85 police cars chasing this guy. And it's like a clown show. Everybody's trying to get through, not wreck. And we're going after this guy. He goes across the bridge into Indiana. Well, of course, he can hear everything on the police radio. He's got the police radio and he hears everything we're doing.
Yeah.
Hey, let's go here. We're going to cut him off here, this, that, and the other. He's going across the bridge into Indiana. So he starts going across the bridge. And then they say, hey, he's got a shotgun in my car. There's a shotgun right above his head. I'm like, oh my gosh. Now he knows we already know he's armed. He's armed anyway.
Is that shotgun secure? How's it secured in the car?
Yeah, the shotgun's secure, but there's a button right here on the dash. I don't know if he knows this or not, but he could hit that button. And very well, he could have done his research. I'd hit the button and your shotgun's out and you go. He can hear all this stuff on the radio. He's going into Indiana, and then I'm right behind him in Indiana, so I'm trying to call it off best I could. Then the car gets behind me. He's calling it off, so now I can just follow. He goes up, does a U-turn, and starts coming back. Now he's going to head back into Kentucky. And all kinds of cars. Now we have Indiana police in on this. We have state police is coming. We have every unit you could think of in the world. We probably got people from California coming by this. So we're going after this guy, and you hear on the radio, they say, let's put some sticks out on Muhammad Ali Boulevard. Well, he hears that. So right before he gets on the bridge to go to Kentucky, he jumps off the road right there. And they're doing a bunch of construction and building a big Outback steakhouse down there. So they had all this construction going on. He goes through this parking lot. I'm right behind him. He hits those little parking barricades, those little concrete parking things. He hits it, goes over it, and then he goes down the hill. And I'm thinking, oh, my gosh, he just flipped this car down the hill into the river. Because we have a river that divides Kentucky and Indiana right there.
Right.
So, boom, he hits it. He goes over. I slam on my brakes, I jump out, and I go running down this hill, and I'm hitting on these rocks, and I remember thinking, oh my gosh, I'm going so fast, and I'm just trying to keep myself from falling. If I fall, I'm going to die. There's no way I'm going to survive if I fall. So I get down to the bottom of the hill, and I realize what he did is he didn't flip the car. He rode it like a sled right into the water. So he's got the police car sitting there in the water. He's standing outside of the car. He's got a gun in his hand. I'm right there at the bank with him on the bank of the river, and I have no cover. I have nothing. It's just me and him, you know, standing there. It turns out there's some other guys that came down there too. There another guy ran right down behind me, but I don't remember seeing him. I was just tunnel visioned on him now.
Mm-hmm.
I draw my weapon. I say, drop the gun. And all I can remember is he looked right at me and he raised the gun up. And I'm thinking, oh my gosh, I'm getting goosebumps now thinking about it. Because mm-hmm. I have nothing to hide behind. I have no cover, nothing. So I just move, I fire off a few rounds and I see him drop the gun. And I'm a pretty decent shot. So I'm thinking, did I miss him? Did I just shoot the gun out of his hand? You know, does he have bulletproof vest on? All this stuff's going through your head in a split second. And the gun goes out of his hand. And the water's about thigh deep, almost waist deep water. But he turns immediately and starts to go back to the police car. He's trying to get back in the police car now to get the shotgun. And I remember thinking, oh my gosh, if he gets that gun, I'm done. I have nowhere to hide. There's nothing to get behind here.
Mm-hmm.
So I just remember tightening up my sights on him and fire off some rounds. I can see bits of his sweater flying off of him. So I knew I was hitting him. And it was weird because I remember thinking, man, he's not reacting like I always expect him to react. I expect him to like jump or fall. And he didn't. He just still trying to get in the car. And then he just stopped trying to get in the car. And then he slowly just started going down into the water. And I remember thinking, man, maybe he's faking it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because he's not reacting like I thought. He's probably faking it. Well, now we have to go in the water to get him out. Then by then, you know, command staff is showing up and I don't remember. It's so chaotic. But we're like, we got to get him out of the water. So we go in the water and drag him out.
And it's 6 degrees outside.
It's 6 degrees. And my uniform pants are now frozen, literally frozen to my skin. You know, it's so cold out there. And I remember asking for a knife or something. And I go to cut his shirt because we have to help him. He's conscious and all this now. So I go to cut his shirt. And that's what I was expecting, to see a vest or something. Like, he had four shirts on, is what it was. He had four layers of shirts. So I'm trying to cut the shirt, not cut him, of course. And now I'm trying to give him CPR right there on the bank of this river. Yep. And I can just remember seeing the blood gush out faster and faster. So I might have been helping the cause, really, on that one, as far as that goes, unfortunately. But I'm trying to give him CPR, and then EMS shows up. They're okay, let me in on him. So then I walked back up, got out of the scene. They took over from there. And I went back up to get in my car to try to get warmed up, and my arms were just covered in blood and, you know, ice water. I remember just sitting there hitting my steering wheel, screaming because I was just so cold. And I just, the adrenaline jump, dump and all that, I guess. But I was so freezing. My hands were frozen and hurting. And I was just hitting the steering wheel. I remember just screaming, you know, not even anything particular, just yelling, you know, mm-hmm. the steering wheel. And then I calmed down and then I had to go in and do my interviews and, you know, all that kind of stuff. So then I'm off work 3 months after that. So Kevin Snead, he didn't make it. Jerry Thorne wound up going to prison over it. But that was the situation with him. And it took 3 months for it to get cleared, come out to be obviously a justified shooting and all that. And it was all cleared and no issues or anything by any means. So I went back to work. And then ironically, I was on the Viper unit. So I pull somebody over and I go to get his ID and it says Kevin Snead on this ID of this guy. This is probably 2 years later.
Really?
No, probably 4 years after the incident. I pull this guy over and says, Kevin Snead. And this guy goes, yeah, that's right. I hate you cops and all this stuff. And I'm like, yeah, you guys killed my dad. And I was like,
whoa.
Oh my gosh. I had no idea. You know, he had no idea. And I had no idea at the time, but I was the one that had to deal with his dad. But, you know, obviously I never said anything, never told him, but he went up getting,
right.
he had guns in the car and all that kind of thing. He's following the same path. Apple doesn't fall far from the tree, I guess.
Yeah.
But of all the people.
Yeah.
I mean, it was a little ironic that came up. So
there's no such thing as 6 degrees of separation anymore.
No, yeah. way less than that.
A lot less. Now, so his partner, he was arrested.
That's right. Yeah. He went up going to prison.
Did he resist at all once the car stopped?
No, once the car stopped, they got him. They swarmed the truck, which I can't stress enough. That's not what you do. Back then, it was, you know, like 2008, they're still doing that kind of stuff, you know, not
right.
supposed to, but oh my gosh, I'd lose my mind when I see people just rushing up on a car like that, you know?
Yeah. It should be about officer safety. Damn. I tell you what, we got my heart racing here. Just listening to the story, and that was a number of years ago.
Yeah.
And you mentioned that you're trying to give CPR. Which some people might think, wait a minute, you just shot this guy, now you're trying to save him?
That's right.
Yeah, that's what we do.
Right, people, even in that situation, we don't try to kill anybody, even a deadly force situation, we just try to stop the threat. Once the threat is stopped, now you just move forward from there. Now, deadly force just means that the force you use is potentially deadly.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't mean that our objective is to heal someone
Kill.
or end someone's life.
Right.
Our objective is to stop the threat. And sometimes that means they lose a life. But actually, we're trying to save lives. We're trying to save civilian lives, but we're also trying to save the suspect life. And
That's right.
People don't understand that part.
Yep. A lot of people, I'm sure they've done the same with you during your career, but I mean, I've had people that I know are intelligent that are not criminals, and they'll say, why don't you just wing them like they do on TV? Have you ever been in a shootout where somebody's shooting at you and you think you can concentrate enough just to shoot the gun out of their hand or shoot them in the elbow or whatever?
Well, and that's just people being uneducated. You know, when I was a police officer going through firearms training, I didn't realize how uneducated I was until I started seeing statistics and understanding about ballistics and human physiological behavior and all this kind of stuff. And, you know, I didn't realize how that works. You know, I didn't understand that. You know, for instance, we had a situation when I was on patrol where I had two detectives. They were involved in a shooting. I actually happened to see them right before they went out to say, we're going to look for this guy that has a warrant. He's on your beat. So just kind of keep your ears open. If we need you, we'll call you. Well, these were two very squared away guys. Well, next thing you know, they're calling for help on the radio. They need backup. And I'm like, man, if these guys need backup, there's something up because they usually don't need any help. So I get there and long story short, I hear shots fired and I go running in to help them. I'm thinking they're in the middle of a gunfight. So I go in to help these guys because they're not answering the radio or anything. And as I go in, I see this guy hitting the ground and gun smoke in the air and all that. And one of my buddies is like, man, did I get hit? Did I get hit? And I'm trying to process the situation, what's going on. Well, what it was, they went to go serve this warrant. And across the hall from this apartment, there was a crack party going on. It was all crazy and loud and everything. So they went over there to see what's going on. And this guy was being real belligerent. They cuffed him and sit him in a chair. They didn't pat him down real quick, though. As they admittedly said that we should have done that, but we didn't. They handcuffed him, put him in the chair. Well, he reaches in his pocket, pulls out a box cutter and comes at the officers. And as they went for the officers, they wound up shooting him. We were carrying 40 caliber Glocks, hit him 12 times, center mass. And that still didn't put him down. The front kick put him down and then he fell. So he was dead on his feet. But there's two ways to stop the threat. There's two ways you can die also, right? You either turn off the plumbing or you turn off the electricity.
Right.
Well, if you punch holes in a waterbed, it leaks until it's not functional anymore. That's how your body works. You either get punctured and you lose blood pressure until you're not conscious anymore. Or the central nervous system, and then you're out. These are things I didn't know. You don't realize that until you get into firearms and you start learning how, you know, things work. If you're literally dead on your feet and you have 7 seconds left before you lose consciousness, how much damage can you do with a box cutter in 7 seconds? You can do quite a bit in a 12 by 12 room when you're already in motion. So these are things that people just don't know because they're uneducated. So when they say, well, can't you just shoot out of their hand? Can't you just shoot them in the leg? Shoot them in the leg, you can kill them too. People don't realize that. So perfect example of that.
Yeah.
Sometimes you die even faster,
you
know, depending. So I don't even get mad at these people when they say those kind of things as much as, you know, like, wow, they're uneducated like I used to be.
Mm-hmm.
So it gives me an opportunity to maybe have a discussion with them, have a conversation with them and try to bring that to them. And I tell you almost every single time they go, man, I never thought about it like that. I said, well, I know you didn't, and that's why I'm telling you. So
a lot of agencies have started citizens academies, which I think it's fantastic because
we have the same thing and I love it. I think it's fantastic.
And
I wish it was mandatory. Everybody went through it.
Absolutely. We went to a fundraiser for the DEA Educational Foundation out in Pacific Palisades, California, and in LA, right there on the beach. Gosh, this is when Narcos first came out on Netflix.
Which, by the way, not to interrupt you right now, but we're at the time right now where man, Pacific Palisades is gone. Fires and stuff. So I just want to reach out and pray for those people out there, man. They're going through a tough time right now, but a beautiful area. Anyway, if somebody ever looks back on this episode, literally right now as we're having this discussion, Pacific Palisades is on fire.
Yeah.
So
yeah, in fact, I guess she's the CEO of the DEA Educational Foundation, Jill. I won't mention her last name because I don't have permission, but they lived in Pacific Palisades. Her husband is a movie producer. And I texted her yesterday, are you guys okay? And she said, we made it out. We got the kids. We got the dogs. And then she stopped. And I mean, after seeing those videos on TV last night and this morning, I'm sure they lost their house. Just devastating what's going on out there. But anyway, so at this fundraiser for them back, I'm going to guess 8 years ago, maybe 9 years ago, the DEA LA Field Division brought out a tent and they brought out their FATS machine, which is the shoot, don't shoot situations. And you'd see these people going everywhere from young people to older people going into the line was just 30, 40 people in line waiting to get in there because everybody wanted to take their turn in that. And when they would come out, their adrenaline, they're spiked with their adrenaline. Some of them, their hands are shaking because they've gotten into that scenario. And it's all computer-based. And you know how it is. You got a little laser gun you shoot, and it registers where your bullets hit, your rounds hit on the screen.
You have to make decisions. You have to make split-second decisions. That's the thing.
And that changes everybody's mind. Once they go through it themselves, they're like, holy cow, this is unbelievable. And, you know, did I do wrong? I'll never make it in law enforcement. Well, you're a person. You need training first. You need some experience, and then you'll know how to handle these situations. But that TV thing, remember the old TV show Cannon? The guy weighed like 400 pounds, and he carried a 2-inch snub-nosed revolver, and he could wing somebody at 300 yards.
Right, right.
It's just unrealistic.
Incredible. The guy was so amazing.
Yeah. But I want to say thank you very much for sharing that story, because I know it's something you have to live with the rest of your life, and it's something I'm sure that you're not proud of. It's just you did your job.
That's another thing is people think that, and I talked to recruits about this in the police academy, is look, if you get into a critical incident like that, the last thing you're doing is going on high-fiving your buddies.
Right.
People think you're doing that. And if anything, you're very quiet. You have to process that. And I'm sure a lot of police officers have read the book On Killing by Lieutenant Grossman. And he talks about how we're not wired to kill people.
Right.
In war, people miss subconsciously. They miss on purpose, not even realizing it, just because we don't want to kill people. If they have a firing squad, you only have one person has the bullet. You don't know who it is, because otherwise you probably wouldn't pull the trigger. And not that any of us want to pull a trigger like that anyway, but we're just not wired for that kind of stuff. So. And it does. It stayed with me for a long time. I kept having, even though I knew it was a justified shooting and everything, and I was, I guess you can say, okay, as far as my actions and everything. And I had no other choice. It was either him or me.
Right. Right. Or one of your partners.
Or exactly, because they were on the bank too. Actually, several of us that went up shooting. But I kept reliving it over and over. Wake up at night screaming. I don't know if I was yelling at him to drop the gun or if I was just yelling. I don't even know what I was yelling over and over. It got to the point where I couldn't even sleep anymore. I was getting so pissed off, basically, because I just wanted a good night's sleep. I just wanted one night where I can make it through the whole night without having to rewind. It was like on replay. The whole scenario just kept going through my head. I kept dreaming about it. After a while, it was gone. Now I don't have any issues with it, but, you know, it kept replaying in my head forever. So it was something I had to deal with. You know, even after I went back to work, I was still dreaming about it, you know, and then every run you make, you're like, man, is this going to be another one? You know, is this
right
situation?
Did they get you counseling?
Yes, they did get counseling, and I recommend it for everybody. I went and talked about it and everything, and it was mandatory. You have to go talk to somebody, make sure that you're okay to come back to work. But even then, the mental health aspect of law enforcement, I think, is very lacking.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody needs some type of counseling in some area for something. It's just for maintenance. If anything, just for maintenance, not even because there's something wrong with you. It's not that. It's just that it's good to talk to people about it that can either relate to it or maybe give you some tools that you can use to deal with certain things that we deal with on the job. Because some people can't handle stress like others. You know, some people have a hard time with death scenes, or some people doesn't seem to bother them. You know, everyone's wired a little differently. Yeah, so I went to counseling for a little bit until I was fine to go back to work. And, you know, and it was good, but it was more of a mandatory thing. I don't feel like I really needed it, but I'm sure I did.
Yeah. In 89, my partner got shot down in Miami. The deformant was killed. My partner survived, but he was off for about a year. And that was the same way. I thought I was a tough guy. I didn't need counseling, and I didn't go. But I was shell-shocked after that. I've been in a lot of shootings in my career, and none really ever bothered me, to be quite honest with you, except this one. It was because my partner was hit. And my wife was a registered nurse. She's retired now. She would slam doors and things in the house after that just to scare me. But the whole point was, and I'm thinking she's just being an evil wife. But the whole point was to show me it's okay. It's over. And that lasted just a couple of weeks, and it went away. But I tell you what, after that, I had dreams about Kevin getting shot. Not nightmares, just reliving the incident. And as I went on in my career, it slowly went away. And I retired in 2013 from DEA, and I haven't had any dreams since then. But that counseling is unbelievably beneficial.
It really is. It really is.
It is. So, now, as bad as that was, and I know I'm beating around the bush here a little bit because this is a tough topic, but you actually suffered a very personal tragedy in your family,
right?
Didn't you?
That's
Can you tell
right.
us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I teach jiu-jitsu, and obviously, and I teach for Gracie University as well. And I go out there to help certify different people, civilians, to be able to open up their own jiu-jitsu academy. So if you're going to open up a jiu-jitsu academy, you have to go through a very stringent instructor certification program. So I'm one of the people on the board, or one of the people as an evaluator to help certify. If you wanted to go teach jiu-jitsu, you have to go through a program, and I'm one of the people that help certify you so you can go out there and open up your own academy and everything. So we do that twice a year, every January, every July. And I was out there in July 2017. And I got a phone call one night. I was out there just one night. And my son, my youngest son, right now, his name's Kai. He was about 7 months old at the time. He's with us. And I got a phone call that my son, Sebastian, wasn't answering his phone. And it was my ex-wife. She was telling me, I think something bad has happened. Can you call, see what's going on? He's supposed to be staying with my mom, she said, so his grandmother. Mm-hmm. And I was like, okay. So I called and called up the radio room, see if anything was happening. And turns out there was a wreck right by his grandmother's house. And ironically, so I called and I said, hey, this is Manganello. I understand there's a wreck out there. Can I talk to somebody? And they said, you need to speak with a supervisor.
You know, that's bad.
I knew that was bad right then, because I've called the radio room 1,000 times and I've never had to speak to a supervisor, you know. Mm-hmm. So they put a supervisor on and I said, you know, hey, this is Manganello. What's going on? They said, you need to speak to somebody at the scene. You need to speak with Sergeant Hamlin. Well, Sergeant Hamlin happened to be one of the instructors I had when I was in the police academy.
Mm-hmm.
So I, you know, obviously knew him pretty well, and very gruff, very, very to the point, loud kind of sergeant. You know? He gets on the phone and he goes, I said, Sarge, this is Manganello. I said, can you talk to me? What's going on here? And I said, I'm trying to find my son. He's not answering the phone. And he said, Mango, I don't want to talk about this over the phone. And I said, Sarge, I'm in California. I need to know what's going on right now. He said, your boy didn't make it. And I said, can you tell me what happened? He said he was on a moped. His car just broke down like 4 days earlier, so he got this moped. And he said he crossed the center line and hit a Ford Explorer head on. He goes, the scene's bad. I said, is there any chance? He goes, Alan, he didn't make it. I said, you got to be kidding me. I said, okay, well, I have to be the one to tell his mom. And he said, well, they're on their way out to her house right now. So I said, let me be the one to tell her. Don't let them tell her. So I called his mom. Of course, she broke down. And then I had to call my daughter. And my daughter was only 2 years younger than him. They were best friends. So I had to let my daughter know, you know, that her older brother had gone. And now I have to get a flight home from California, play my son's funeral. So that was the toughest trip of my life, because I just couldn't get here fast enough. So to fly home to play my son's funeral and everything. And so I called everybody I could, let everybody know what's going on. I have to call family. So every phone call was, it seemed like it was just getting more difficult than the last.
Yeah.
And while I was at the funeral home, next thing you know, the SWAT team starts showing up one by one. They start filing in single file. And excuse me, I get a little emotional on this one.
I probably will too.
But it was powerful, because they all came in as a team, and you know, they all lined up just to show their support, came up, shook my hand, you know, paid the respect for my boy. My boy was friends with a lot of them. You know, he actually went on SWAT training with me one day.
Yeah.
They let him come in and do some SWAT training with me. So a lot of them knew who he was. So it was pretty powerful that they were in there. They just showed their support and their solidarity and how much of a family they were to me. Well, what was interesting was, you mentioned earlier, you said we don't want to do funeral escorts and all that kind of stuff. Well, we weren't allowed to do those anymore. We had some kind of new policy that said you couldn't do funeral escorts. Only the sheriff's department can do it, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, the chief comes in, and as I'm standing there by the casket with my boy, he comes up and the chief goes, you know, is there anything you need at all? Anything you need? And I said, yeah, chief, there is. There is one thing you can do for me. He said, what's that? I said, my son was super good friends. He was really good friends with Sean Verdi and with Charles Robinson, two of my beat partners. I'm asking that you'll break the policy and let them escort him into the cemetery. And the chief stopped for a second. I said, I know it's not policy and everything. It's against our policy to do that, but I'm asking you for this one favor. You asked if there's anything I wanted. That's what I want. And he thought for a minute and he goes, Alan, I'm going to do one better. He got the whole traffic unit to block off the entire pass from the funeral home all the way to the cemetery, almost like it was a law enforcement type of thing. Not the lesson law enforcement, you know, dying on duty or anything, but he was
right.
Police family, and they wanted me to know that he was family.
Mm-hmm.
So they closed it off the whole way, and it was an incredible procession. It was beautiful. My son would have been so proud, so happy for it.
Yeah.
And brought him right in, and it was incredible. And the police department, what they did is they gave me a family I never had before. Growing up, I didn't have, if you heard in episode one, people were listening to that. I didn't have the best home life with my parents and everything like that. They weren't good people, and I didn't have anybody to learn from. And I met some of the best people in the police department as well. It was one of the best decisions I ever made. And this was the family I never had in my life. I mean, we always heard the thin blue line and the camaraderie we have and the brotherhood and the sisterhood and all that, but I had no idea. I had no idea it was that deep until they stepped up. I had people come in from other agencies coming in and showing support. People I never even met before coming to show the support. And that's just what they do. And I had some of my good friends that I used to work off duty at the bars with. They're the ones that made the scene. And I didn't realize that until I was at the funeral home. They showed up and they said, hey, Alan, I was the one that made the scene.
Wow.
One girl in particular. And I just broke down with her because I can just imagine what she went through too. Right. It's something she'll never forget. She calls me every year on the anniversary of the thing to let me know she's thinking about me and that she'll never forget it either. So it's a bonding we have now. Mm-hmm. And so one thing I do now where I teach, I go around and I teach what's called Gracie Survival Tactics. It's a law enforcement course. We teach the train the trainer course that I teach for Gracie University, probably the best defensive tactic program on the planet as far as I'm concerned. And obviously, because I wouldn't teach it if it wasn't. Mm-hmm. But what I do on the very first day is I go through and I memorize everybody's name, their first name on day one.
That's what Mike Denton said you did that.
My record is 87. And I try to get them all by lunchtime. But at the end of the day, on day one, on that Monday, it's a Monday through Friday course. On Monday, I go through, I let everybody know, hey, listen, while I've been teaching you today, I've been trying to learn everybody's name. I want to see if I can go through and do it. And I said, just simply nod your head yes if I say your name. If it's correct, if it's not right, just say no, but don't tell me what it is. Let me dig. Let me try to figure out what it is because I really, really want to know who you are. So I go through and I memorize everybody's name. And I go through and I say, it's John, Sally, Becky, whatever. And I go through everybody's name at the end. And then I get everybody, I always do. I make sure I memorize everybody's first name. And everybody's at the end, oh my gosh, that was incredible. How you do it? What's the secret? And they'll ask me at the end of the day or even the next day, how do you do that? We're going to talk about it. And later on in the week, we'll talk about it. On the Friday, at the end of the course at graduation, after they're all done everything, saying my goodbyes and thanking for the week and everything, I tell them the story about my son, explain what happened. And I tell them the reason I learned, everybody asked me what the trick is. And I said, the trick is really, there's no trick. It's the fact that I care. It's just that I care. Simply, if you care enough about something, you'll do it.
Yeah.
If you don't remember somebody's name that you met, it's only because you didn't care what their name was. It's very simple.
Yeah.
People say, I'm not good with names. Everybody's good with names. You'll remember the people's names that you care about. And what I tell them, the reason I do that is because the law enforcement family gave me the family I never had in my life. So the least I can do to repay them is to remember the most personal thing you have in your life, which is your first name. Not your last name, your first name. And ironically, it's the one thing in your life you had nothing to do with. You pick everything in your life, your house, your car, your wife, your everything, your shirt, the way you look. Everything is pretty much by your design, except for your first name. But it is the most personal thing you have. So I make it a point to memorize everybody's name in my course as my way of saying thank you because the police department gave me a family that I never had and I always want.
I was good with names when I was younger. I blame it on old age. And there's a drug out there that they advertise on TV that's supposed to help your memory when you're older. I just can't remember the name. That's fantastic. So, and that's a perfect segue into jiu-jitsu. You started training at a very young age. You bought your academy, I think, in your mid-20s. Now you're retired from law enforcement. And I guess some people say, well, I guess you're doing this as a retirement job, but you're not just training at your academy. You're traveling around the United States teaching law enforcement. And tell us what the objective is of doing that, other than, you know, you need some extra money for retirement, I guess, but also what's the real purpose of doing that?
No, the real purpose, you know, the money's just bonus. You know, I work for Gracie University under Henry Gracie and Hedon Gracie. And I tell Henry all the time, listen, I would do this for free if I could. Mm-hmm. You know, I love it that much. It's my passion. Jiu-jitsu and law enforcement are my passions. And if I can teach jiu-jitsu to law enforcement, it's a win-win situation. It's the best of both worlds, you know.
Yeah.
The reason I do it is because law enforcement doesn't get enough training. And not only don't they get enough training, the training they do get is very inadequate. My passion is to go around and try to teach people how to defend themselves. Because when I was in the police academy, I was in the police academy for 4.5 years. That's where I retired from. I was in the academy as an instructor before I left. And I would tell my recruits, I would tell them, listen, you're going to learn all kinds of great skills in this academy. You're going to learn how to write reports. You're going to learn how to talk to people. You're going to learn how to do CPR. You're going to learn how to shoot. You're going to learn how to fight. You're going to learn how to drive. All these cool skills that most people don't ever get to learn.
Sorry.
But I said, there's two things that I can guarantee you. I don't know if you'll ever use CPR. I don't know if you'll ever have to use some of the skills we teach you, but there's two things I can promise you. You're going to get in a fight and you're going to get in a car wreck. If you're going to do 25 years as a police officer, there's no way around it. Right. Now, I don't know what kind of wreck it's going to be. It could be a fender bender. Back out of a parking space when you're at dinner and you hit a pole. That was me. Okay. You might have to call Sarge and say, I got to do a damaged equipment form now. I just dented the fender on my police car. Yeah. Or it could be a fatality. I don't know what kind of fight you're going to be in. You could be the guy's just struggling to get away because he doesn't want to go to jail. Or it could be a fight for your life. Mm-hmm. Three times in my life, I've been in a fight for my life. One was that gunfight we talked about, and two others were hand-to-hand, but the guys wanted to kill me. And if I didn't have my training, I wouldn't be here in this interview today. It's quite literally. So my objective is to go around and teach every police officer I can possibly teach on this planet until the day I die, because they need more training. And you mentioned earlier, you've been into several fights in your life and you broke your hand. Mm-hmm. More than once, maybe.
Mm-hmm. Right? Unfortunately.
And guess which hand it was?
Main one.
Your gun hand.
Yep.
So because of the training that we have, I went 22 years in the police department, Viper unit, SWAT team, been in many fights, a lot of foot chases, car chases. I've been in all kinds of fights in 22 years, never punched one person, ever.
Wow.
Never threw a punch, never broke my hand. My hand's still good. And I'm not saying, oh, look at me and ragging on me. It's training. It's mm-hmm. the system that we teach, you don't have to punch. Because why do police officers punch? To gain
that's
compliance.
What we know to say. Do.
Yeah, it's, right. Yeah, that's always the answer. It's what we've always done, right? But what's interesting is my son, Kai, who's 8 right now, when he was 2, if he'd get mad, he would swing a punch. And I'm like, that's interesting. I never taught him how to punch. But it's our innate ability. That's what we do. That's just our go-to. Our default.
Right, right.
When you get mad at something, you lose control. You want to hit something. That's just what we do. So we have to reprogram ourselves to not do that. And there's other options that we have. There's ways to use body weight, joint manipulation, and ways to control the person and make them want to give up. The difference between striking arts and jujitsu is when you strike, what does that do? Why do police officers strike? They do it to gain compliance.
True.
Well, tell me any officer who gets punched by a subject that's going to say, okay, you win, you can leave. No, you're going to fight back harder.
Mm-hmm.
Of course you are. So what makes you think the suspect's going to do anything different? In fact, I tell people, if you punch somebody and they give up, you probably didn't need to punch them.
True.
You probably could have talked to them a little bit with a stern voice and they probably would have given up. They're not that strong-willed. Once you hit somebody, that does a few things. Number one, it makes them more mad and want to fight back harder, or you break your hand, or you do more damage than you mean to. So striking has a lot more negative connotations to it than it does anything positive. So if we have a way that we can control somebody, hold them down and not let them up until they give up, until they exhaust themselves, or put them into a joint lock, control them somehow. When we have volume control, you can do a joint lock, give a little pain pressure, and then let it go, and then talk to them. Hey, man, I'll let go of your arm as soon as you stop fighting me. Yes or no? If the answer is yes, I can let you up. I'll put your handcuffs first, let you up. Or if the answer is no, I put a little bit more pressure, get your attention again, come back down. We have a little volume control. Now I have negotiating power. When you punch somebody or kick somebody, you don't have negotiating power.
True.
So that's what we teach in our defensive tactics program. It's how to change their mind. I don't want to break somebody's arm. I want to break their spirit. Just like if
good
I shoot
point.
Somebody, I don't want to kill them. I want to stop the threat. So I'm not trying to break anybody's arm. I'm not trying to kill somebody with a choke. I'm trying to stop the threat. And I'm trying to gain compliance. What's the ultimate goal of law enforcement? Here's what most people don't even realize. If you ask different officers, what's the ultimate goal of law enforcement? You're going to hear things like get home at night, right? Make sure you go home at night. And I disagree with that. Because, of course, I want to get home at night. But if I go home tonight with one eye instead of two, by definition, I achieve my goal. That's not acceptable to me.
Right.
If I come home tonight with a colostomy bag, that's not acceptable to me. So that can't be the ultimate goal of law enforcement. The ultimate goal of law enforcement isn't even to gain compliance. Because I'll gain compliance one way or another. They may not like it, right? My ultimate goal is to gain voluntary compliance. Right? When we show up on scene, who's in charge? We are. I don't want to fight somebody every single run I make. That'd be exhausting. Can you imagine if I make 14 runs a day, I get into 14 fights a day? That's going to be a long career or a very short one.
That's a long day.
Right? Yeah. So my goal is when I show up, if you're fighting your neighbor because his leaves are blown in your yard and you're in an argument, I'm going to tell your neighbor, can you please stop letting the leaves blow in his yard? Mm-hmm. When I go to a bar and they say, hey, this guy needs to leave the bar. Hey, I want you to leave the bar. Well, I didn't do nothing wrong. I can get him out of the bar, trust me. But I'd much rather him get up and leave on his own accord.
Right.
So my job is to convince you to do what is right. And that's what jiu-jitsu is all about, is I just want to change your mind. I want to make you not want to fight me anymore. I want to make you not want to hurt people anymore. But on your own decision.
I think that's long, long overdue. It's the older I get now, and I'm probably just a little bit too old to be rolling around and learning everything. If I fight now, I'm going to break something.
Never too old. You know the best time to start jiu-jitsu?
When?
There's two times when you're 9 years old and today. Let me tell all our listeners out there too. There's only two types of people in this world. I don't care what race you are. I don't care what political stand you have, whatever. There's only two types of people. There's people who train jiu-jitsu, and there's people who need to train jiu-jitsu. That's true. It. So which bowl are you in? So that's it.
Yeah. And the more I've been doing a lot with military lately, former military folks, and they're really, really into jiu-jitsu. I think that should be included. When we went to the academy, we did boxing. We did grappling, a lot of grappling, because that's, you do more wrestling around on the street than you do striking, because you do break things. But I think it's long, long overdue that should be incorporated into all law enforcement training, because inevitably you're going to get in a fight.
No, you will. Not only will you get in a fight, but the fight's going to go to the ground.
Yeah.
And I'll ask people when I'm teaching the course, I'll say, how many people have ever been in a fight with somebody and it didn't go to the ground? And it's maybe you might get one or two out of 100 people that say that. I'll say, how many people got in a fight with somebody and it went to the ground? Everybody raises their hand. Mm-hmm. I go, how many people have ever punched somebody before? You get a bunch of people raise their hand. How many people hurt their hand? Same people.
Mm-hmm.
Oh my gosh. I'm like, the same people. And it's your gun hand. So now if you're in a fight, you break your hand, right? And now that fight turns south, you need your firearm. You're putting yourself at a serious risk right now.
Absolutely. All good common sense things here. If people want to find out more about you and your academy, and especially we've got a ton of law enforcement here and military that listen to this podcast, where can they find you at?
Well, my academy is Gracie Jiu-Jitsu Louisville. And if you go to GracieLouisville.com, GRACIE, and then Louisville, LOUISVILLE, GracieLouisville.com is our website. But you can also go to GracieUniversity.com, Gracie, and then university.com/GST, Gracie Survival Tactics. So it's GracieUniversity.com/GST. That gives you the law enforcement program that we specifically teach. And that's open for all first responders, law enforcement, military, fire, EMS, anybody. That's really what you want to learn. You want to be able to learn what's called Gracie Survival Tactics. That's the way to go.
Absolutely. So you got it there. Again, the website is Gracie, G-R-A-C-I-E, Louisville.com. Especially if you're in a training capacity within not just law enforcement, any first responder agency. It's sad to say that, but firemen get attacked. EMTs get attacked. Military's getting attacked. Everybody can benefit from this. Not to mention, it's a great exercise regimen to be involved with as well to keep yourself in shape. Go check out. Ask for Alan. You know what? If he can't help you, he'll put you in contact with somebody.
Right. We also have we just developed a system. Henner Gracie, as a matter of fact, just developed an incredible system that's changing the world right now. It's called the SafeWrap. And it's a way that you control a subject with two officers. They can arrest anybody without, and it's a whole other subject right here, but without having to put them in the prone position. Or not arresting them in the prone position. You have them in the prone position, but what are some challenges of the prone position? The person can push up. They can reach for weapons. They can get up to their feet and all that. They have a hard time breathing sometimes. But we found a way that you can put them in a lateral position where they're on their side, totally control mm-hmm. them, and handcuff them from that position. So we're starting to teach that in our GST program as well, called the SafeWrap system.
And if you're a law enforcement agency and you're looking for references, reach out to Alan, or you can reach out to me through GameOfCrimesPodcast.com or GameOfCrimesPodcast@gmail.com. If you look for a reference, I'll put you in touch with Mike Denton, who works over in Orlando Police Training Unit, and he can tell you exactly. He's got firsthand knowledge. They just went through it, I think, two or three weeks ago?
Probably about a month ago or so. That's right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So take advantage of this. It's not free. The man's got to eat. He's got to travel to you and everything, but it's certainly worth, what's it worth to avoid a lawsuit down the road and to protect your people? That's where the focus should be, protect our first responders. Alan, any last words that you want to leave with us here before we call this off?
I just want to say thank you for your time. First of all, for you, Murph, for bringing me on here and giving myself, this is almost my therapy session. It's a chance I get to kind of talk a little bit and get some things out as well. So I appreciate you listening and having me on there. And I want to thank our viewers out there too, for everything that they're doing. All you first responders out there. And even you firefighters, you second responders, it's all good. Okay.
We'll make sure to take a shot.
That's right. And, you know, I tell everybody in the course too, I said, are there any firefighters in here? No second responders? Oh, it's okay. Then we're the only ones that can make fun of you guys, because you're like our siblings. We'll make fun of you, but anybody else does, we'll fight for you. You know,
we'll
take it to the mat for sure.
Man,
we love all you guys out there, and I'm so glad you guys are out there doing what you're doing. And because you're doing what you're doing, it allows me to be able to do what I do.
Yeah.
I really appreciate that, and I love all of you.
And with your permission, Alan, we were going to dedicate this episode to Sebastian Manganiello in honor of you and in honor of him. So if that's okay.
I appreciate that, and that'd be a big honor. Big honor. That's my boy.
Yeah. I understand, man. And I'm going to go now because I'm going to start tearing up again. And that's when I cry, it's ugly. It's
allergies. Allergies are kicking in. That's what it is right here. So.
Yeah, it's too damn cold for allergies right now. But hey, everybody, listen, thank you again so much for coming to join us here on Game of Crimes with Murph in the Morning. What I tell you, I told you at the very beginning of part one that had another special guest on board. Here's a man that dedicated his life to law enforcement, not realizing that's what he wanted to do. And even in retirement, is continuing to do everything he can to support law enforcement for all of our first responders to better protect you and me. Okay. So
Look me up on, I'm on Facebook, Alan Manganiello on Facebook, as well as Gracie Jiu-Jitsu Louisville. On Instagram, I'm Gracie Louisville, just on Instagram there too. I don't have a personal one on there, but I'd love to keep in contact with you guys. If you want to look me up, talk, chat, send me a message, anything. Be happy to talk with you guys.
There you go, everybody. Reach out to that man. Even if you just want to chat, that don't mean you have to hire him. He's one of us.
That's right.
So looking forward to everybody joining us next week for the next episode of Game of Crimes. But just want to say thank you again before you leave here. Thank you for joining the biggest, baddest, most dangerous game of all, the Game of Crimes. See you folks next week. Well, unfortunately, that's it for this week's episode of Game of Crimes with Murph in the Morning. Thank you folks so much for taking the time to see and hear some of the best true crime content you can find anywhere. None of this would be possible without your support. If you didn't know this already, Game of Crimes is now on YouTube. Just type in Game of Crimes Podcast in the YouTube search bar. You can send me your comments on Apple, Spotify, YouTube, or to our email address, which is gameofcrimespodcast@gmail.com. Our website, it's gameofcrimespodcast.com. That's where you'll find all our episodes, books written by our guests, merchandise, and more. If you're looking for even more content, now go over to patreon.com/gameofcrimes and sign up. There you'll find several bonus episodes each month, ranging from serious and current topics to some silly and fun events. And you can even get early access to each week's interviews before they drop on YouTube or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can even subscribe for free and hear the first 5 minutes of each episode, and that's to help you decide if you'd like to spend some of your hard-earned cash to hear more. That's patreon.com/gameofcrimes. To all our guests here on Game of Crimes, it's an honor and a pleasure to have you on the show. I mean that sincerely. Thank you for your service to your communities, your countries, and for taking the time to tell us about your adventurous lives. May God bless and protect all the men and women in law enforcement, our military, and all of our first responders. And you know what? This goes for all of our listeners as well. Thank you for your continued support. And just one last thought here. It's okay for us to have different ideas and different opinions, but it doesn't mean we can't continue to be friends. All right. My final thank you. Thanks for joining me again to play the biggest, the baddest, the most dangerous game of all, the Game of Crimes. I'll see y'all next week.